The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Scott Heath for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Indie Week. For the next hour, we'll be reading from the Independent Weekly across election results and news from the Triangle. Raleigh City Council at-large primary, Forte Siddiqui lead. Incumbent Stormy Forte placed first in Tuesday's Raleigh City Council at-large primary as expected, followed by small business owner Sana Siddiqui in second place. With 33% and 24% of votes, respectively, they are the frontrunners among four candidates who advance to the November general election and compete for two at-large seats. This campaign has always been about listening to people across our city and working toward a stronger future for Raleigh, Siddiqui told the Indy. I'm thankful for the support and looking forward to the work ahead. Clark Reinhardt, a longtime pastor turned business consultant, and Josh Bradley, a self-described socialist, also made the cut, although they have a slim chance at winning in November if the primary is any indication. This is Bradley's fourth attempt at election, following unsuccessful city council runs in 2019, 2022, and 2024, in which he placed sixth out of seven candidates. This is the first time Raleigh has held a city council primary. Though it was nonpartisan, it surprisingly drew mostly Democratic candidates, with the exception of Republican James Bledsoe and Bradley, who is a Green Party member. Bradley edged out Bledsoe by only 575 votes. He and his campaign collective watched results come in at an Indian restaurant in North Raleigh, he said. In the District C primary, longtime incumbent Corey Branch and Jared Olison, a deputy with the Wake County Sheriff's Office, advanced. Branch, who won more than 50% of the vote, is widely expected to be reelected. The current city council has a solid pro-growth majority, with most members committed to denser urban development and more housing. Still, there are a few voices who tend to swing on issues of large-scale development, namely Megan Patton, Jane Harrison, and Christina Jones. Patton and Harrison have each spoken about the need for environmental sustainability, while Jones has placed more weight on community concerns around neighborhood preservation. Every seat on the council, including the mayor's, is set to appear on the ballot in the fall, though incumbents are favored to win. Still, the council will get at least one new member this year who could tip some housing and development votes. If elected for another term, Forte wrote in her Indy questionnaire that she would prioritize addressing a, quote, growing unsheltered community, aging infrastructure, and the need for more public safety employees for the Raleigh Police and Fire Departments. Forte also highlighted her big idea to attract a Major League Baseball team to Raleigh. The majority of current city council members have said they support putting another affordable housing bond before voters in November. Raleigh's first affordable housing bond for $80 million was approved by 72% of voters in 2020. For a future bond, Forte has said she'd recommend $100 million as opposed to the $200 million some activists have proposed. Siddiqui, Reinhardt, and Bradley each said they would also support a future affordable housing bond in the responses to Indy questionnaires. Siddiqui, however, said that was only so long as council members, quote, clearly communicate the expected outcomes and how the funds would be used. Increasing supply alone isn't enough, she wrote. When public dollars or land use incentives are used, we should require clear income targeting and longer affordability periods. As of mid-2025, the city council had spent $56 million worth of the bond, according to a presentation from Amelia Sutton, director of the Department of Housing and Neighborhoods. Per Sutton, that money funded the creation of 891 affordable units through public-private partnerships and low-income housing tax credit gap financing, the acquisition of land for more than 300 new units, and home buyer assistance or home repairs for an additional 107 units. But critics have pointed out that much of the new housing is designed to be affordable to people making up to 80% of the area median income, or up to $72,950 for a single person in Raleigh. Some activists argue the city council isn't prioritizing its most vulnerable residents, people with low or extremely low income, up to $46,450 for a single person. That includes Bradley, who wrote that a future bond should fund the construction of housing for residents who make under 50% AMI and who are unhoused. The city needs to prioritize housing for the working class and poor, he wrote. I decided to run because I feel that for far too long, the council has catered to the needs of wealthy developers and donors who do not represent the people. Reinhardt, who was tucking his child into bed when the election results came in, has some more creative ideas when it comes to affordable housing. One possible solution he supports is the growing Yes in God's Backyard movement, which proposes building more housing through partnerships with nonprofits and faith-based organizations, which may own valuable but underutilized real estate in city centers. Don't imagine historical steeples being demolished, but rather surface parking lots that are owned by these tax-exempt organizations being activated for the public good, Reinhardt wrote in his Indy questionnaire. Reinhardt told the Indy he's incredibly grateful to his family and the volunteers who supported him. Having gotten through the primary, he sees, quote, a very clear path forward. There's a lot of work to do to catch up between now and November 3rd, he said. Today I'm focused on regrouping and proud to have the trust of so many Raleighites. Back to the drawing board for me. All the city council races in November are expected to be contested except for District B, where Patton is running unopposed. And because of changes implemented in May 2024, the mayor, top vote getter in the at-large race, and District A and B council members will be elected to four-year terms in 2026 rather than the current two. Results are unofficial until certified. Additionally, this story has been updated with post-election comments from Reinhardt. You can comment and see more on this story at backtalk@indyweek.com. Moving on to Durham election information. In Durham, D.A. DeBerry is reelected while Judge Jones is unseated. Candidates backed by the Durham Association of Educators swept the school board on Tuesday, marking a shift in power and experience on the board at a contentious time between the workers' union and the district. Four of seven seats on the Durham Public Schools Board of Education were on the ballot. Those races were nonpartisan elections, not primaries, so the winners will be sworn in July. With four newcomers voted in, more than two decades of collective experience will exit the board. Only one incumbent, Bettina Umstead, sought re-election, and she was defeated in her District 2 race by Nadine Beer, who won with a comfortable 61% of votes cast. Umstead, in second place, had about 27%. Beer works in human resources and finance for a media collective and co-founded Mothers for Ceasefire. Umstead served two terms on the board and served as chair from 2020 to 2024. In District 1, Katie Bent-Kitaife secured about 68% of the vote. Bent-Kitaife, who is heavily involved in Durham schools as a parent, has a research and public health background. In addition to the DAE, she locked in endorsements from the People's Alliance and the Durham Committee on the Affairs of Black People, PACS. Dilsey Burton, an assistant attorney general, came in second place with 21%. In District 3, Gabby Rivera won about 52% of the vote. K-12 education policy professor Lauren Sartain came in second with about 33%. Rivera followed a therapeutic dance company. Rivera founded a therapeutic dance company and serves on the city's Recreation Advisory Committee. Javier Carson will return to the board after winning the District 4 race with about 50% of the votes. Javier Carson is a longtime educator who left the school board shortly after the start of his second term to direct the Bull City Schools Partnership. Former DAE president and DPS teacher Christy Moore came in second with about 30% of the votes cast. Tuesday's primary also decided, or effectively decided, the other local races on Durham's voters' ballots. Durham's district attorney, sheriff, and clerk of court all won re-election, along with one district court judge. Another district court judge was unseated, and a newcomer will fill an open superior judge seat. State Senator Sophia Chitlick won her primary against former Durham City Council member Dedriana Freeman, and is likely to sail through a general election challenge from a Republican candidate who hasn't mounted a public campaign. District Attorney Satana DeBerry won her third term, beating out defense attorney Jonathan Wilson in a head-to-head Democratic primary for the second time. She was first elected in 2018 amid a national movement for prosecutorial reform. DeBerry campaigned on what the district attorney's office had accomplished under her 8 years, closing cold case assaults, clearing court debt, and using diversion programs to help people charged with crimes get treatment for mental illness and substance use while focusing prosecution on violent crimes. Wilson, despite receiving endorsements from the Durham Committee and the Friends of Durham, among others, could not overcome DeBerry's widespread support as the incumbent. DeBerry won with 61% of the vote, having secured the coveted People's Alliance endorsement. Sheriff. Clarence Burkhead handily won a third term, having served in the role since 2018. Burkhead secured 85% of the vote to defeat challenger Johnny Hawkins, a law enforcement veteran who previously ran detention centers for the Durham County Sheriff's Office. Burkhead ran on his record, emphasizing that the Sheriff's Office had expanded educational and substance use programs in the county jail, reduced vacancies and call times, and attained jail accreditation by three major accreditors. Durham will get two new judges, in fact, after Tuesday's election. Mira Griffin will take the seat that Superior Court Judge Michael Ofagluda is vacating after more than 20 years. Griffin won about 69% of the vote to defeat Assistant Attorney General Amisha Cooper Chester. Griffin is the longtime North Carolina Industrial Commissioner. In that role, she presides over workers' compensation and tort claims appeals. Durham has four Superior Court judges who hear higher-level criminal and civil cases throughout the region and serve eight-year terms. With Ofagluda's upcoming departure, the Chief Justice will need to rename a new resident Superior Court judge for Durham, which usually hinges on seniority. Durham's district court bench will also get one new judge after challenger Christy Malott defeated him with about 67% of votes cast. Malott is a senior assistant attorney for Durham County with 20 years of experience in family law. Jones has served as a district court judge since 2019, but likely lost support during the campaign season after he was charged with domestic violence. He was later found not guilty. Durham has six district court judges. Incumbent Doretta Walker, who was also on the ballot Tuesday, soundly won another term with 75% of the votes cast, despite the People's Alliance declining to make an endorsement between her and challenger Keith Bishop. Clerk of Superior Court Amina Thompson had the biggest margin of the night, receiving 87% of the vote. In her re-election bid, Thompson touted her work leading the clerk's office through the transition to e-courts and improving access to the clerk's office through new forms and communications initiatives. Senate District 22. State Senator Sophia Chitlick won a second term in office. She received about 65% of the vote, holding back former Durham City Council member Deidreana Freeman. As a lawmaker, Chitlick has focused on child care. She emphasized what she's accomplished in just over a year in office, including filing more than 50 bills, getting an amendment passed into law, and responding to hundreds of constituent calls and emails. The rest of Durham's legislative delegation is also up for re-election this year, but did not draw opponents from their parties. They are either unopposed in the fall or do not face challengers likely to prevail in their super blue district. All results are official until certified. Nita Alam concedes to Valerie Fushi in North Carolina primary. When Durham County Commissioner Nita Alam finally took the stage around midnight at an election night party at the Fruit in Durham, her supporters had spent hours eagerly waiting for a result that never came. Incumbent Rep. Valerie Fushi had taken an early edge around 8:30 p.m. when results from early voting and mail-in ballots were posted. As Orange, Chatham, and Durham counties reported votes over the next 3 hours, the New York Times website, projected onto the big screen at the Fruit, showed Fushi's purple bar slightly outpacing Alam's teal. Around 10 p.m., a representative for the People's Alliance, the Durham PAC that co-hosted the watch party, took to the stage to declare victory in several down-ballot races. The DJ went home to walk the dog. Reporters started getting restless. Finally, by 11:45 p.m., only Wake County still had a few precincts to report, and Alam's path to victory seemed to have all but closed. When all precincts reported results, Fushi had 61,537 votes to Alam's 60,335. "What a night, y'all," Alam said from the stage. As expected, Fushi won Orange County while Alam won Durham County. Voters in the portion of the district that lies in Chatham County favored Fushi, while voters in Wake County went for Alam. With the vote difference falling within the 1% margin, Alam said she would be exercising her right to call for a recount. As Alam spoke, Fushi's team sent out a brief press release from her private watch party in Hillsborough, thanking her constituents for giving her a third term. That recount, pending provisional and overseas military ballots, will be officially announced in the coming days, but 1,200 votes is a lot to make up in a recount. For Fushi, even a slim victory over Alam is something of a vindication. She beat Alam in a race for the same seat 4 years ago, and Alam has argued that Fushi would not have won if outside groups had not spent millions to back her. This year, the candidates received roughly equal amounts of outside support, albeit from very different sources. Fushi has served at nearly every level of local government since her first election to the Orange County School Board in 1997. That deep experience and her willingness to put her head down and do the work made up the backbone of her pitch to voters. Nobody else has the experience. Nobody else has developed the relationships. Nobody else knows the district better than me, she told the Indy in a December interview. While Alam dominated the campaign conversation on social media, Fushi sold herself as a background operator who wasn't interested in self-promotion. My goal is to be successful in achieving the goals of the district, and so I have developed a way of doing that. That may not get me noticed by the media, because you don't see me standing on steps with a microphone or megaphone. Nationally, Fushi's re-election deals a blow to the David Hogg, Bernie Sanders, and Zoran Mamdani-affiliated wings of the party. Hogg's organization, Leaders We Deserve, and others that are dedicated to electing younger, more outspoken Democrats, spent over $600,000 to support Alam. A group of Mamdani supporters spent over $1 million on ads and mailers for her as well. And in February, Sanders stopped by a packed Durham Convention Center to stump for Alam. Since 2022, advocates in the district, including Alam, have sharply criticized Fushi for her support of Israel, even as her messaging slowly moved away from that support and turned toward expressing concern for the people of Gaza, and she swore off money from her largest pro-Israel supporter. Fushi, like most politicians, receives campaign donations from a variety of PACs affiliated with corporations and interest groups. Alam, who has rejected corporate support, contrasted Fushi's funding to her own Sanders-style messaging around holding corporations accountable. Last week, Alam's campaign was handed more ammunition when a PAC associated with Anthropic, one of the country's largest AI companies, spent $1.6 million on Fushi. Alam's outside donors this year spent over $2 million on advertisements across TV, radio, social media, and mailers. The two had roughly the same amount of outside support. Both Alam and Fushi are progressives, and their voting records in Congress would look very similar. Fushi gambled that, in the second Trump term, Democratic voters would stick with a proven leader rather than a younger candidate who tends to be more vocal on social media. Alam argued that Democratic voters want to see a representative who is more willing to push back against Trump. When federal enforcement agents showed up in the Triangle last fall, Alam filled agents, posted on social media, and held press conference at the county courthouse. That difference in style was apparent most recently in their approach to an unpopular proposal for a data center in western Wake County. Alam quickly came out in support of Sanders' national data center moratorium, and her campaign helped circulate a letter from residents that asked candidates to reject funding from tech companies. Fushi initially said that it was a local zoning decision and would be up to the Apex Town Council. She later clarified that she was against the data center build, but did not want to be a thorn in the side of a town council members and mayors. In a December interview, Fushi described her political career as part of her belief in public service, quote, seeing a need and wanting to give back to a village, a community that had given to me. And even in the era of social media trends and outrage farming, she said that she would stick to her own tried and true style of service. I'm grateful to have had the opportunity to serve, Fushi said at a final campaign stop in Durham over the weekend. I serve because I was ordained to serve. Make no mistake about it, this is not something I do for performance. It is something I do because it's not something I do because it's flashy. Results are unofficial until certified. And continuing on about the proposed data center, residents raised concerns about proposed data center storage facility in rural Wake County. After months of discussion, developers have withdrawn applications for the proposed data center near Apex. Natelli Investments, LLC, confirmed to the Indy Thursday afternoon that it was withdrawing its plans for the New Hill Digital Campus. Natelli Investments announced today that it is withdrawing its annexation and rezoning applications for property adjacent to the Sheeran-Harris nuclear plant and designated for future industrial development within the town's growth plan, while the town continues its deliberations over zoning ordinance changes necessary to permit data center development within the town's limits. Michael Natelli, the Maryland-based developer's executive vice president, wrote in a statement, "The company indicated it will determine an appropriate course of action if, in the future, the town of Apex ultimately approves a comprehensive zoning text amendment allowing data centers as an approved use within the town's limits." Alex Mayor Pro Tem Terry Mahaffey shared the news in a newsletter Thursday afternoon. "The project will not be moving forward. It's over," he wrote. Mahaffey also wrote that he intends to put forward a motion on Tuesday's town council meeting for a one-year moratorium, quote, "on any further applications, permits, or construction of data centers in Apex." The moratorium will give the town council time to update its unified development ordinance, he said. Apex and New Hill area residents had been vocal in their opposition to the project. More than 5,000 people have signed an online petition against it. Plans called for a digital campus on a 190-acre farm property currently zoned for residential use off Old U.S. Highway 1 in New Hill in unincorporated Wake County, Jane Porter reported in September 2025. The company's release at the time said that the Data Center would, quote, "support the processing and storage requirements of digital applications for residents in Apex and the Greater Triangle area," end quote. Most recently, concerns bloomed from not only environmental noise and energy and water consumption to town resources, including strain on fire and public safety services. Concerns around data centers aren't unique to Western Wake. Nearby Chatham County recently voted to put a temporary hold on the permitting of data centers, data processing facilities, cryptocurrency mining operations, and any other associated uses. A global chemical giant racks up violations in Durham, where drinking water for a million is threatened. Brentag Mid-South continues to amass serious environmental violations related to its chemical repackaging plant in East Durham, where state inspectors cited the company in November for failing to clean up leaking barrels on the property. Recent testing also shows a chemical cocktail continues to enter a neighborhood stream that runs behind an elementary school, through a public park, and flows into Third Fork Creek and Jordan Lake, the drinking water supply for more than a million people, according to the North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality. Pardon me. City and state agencies have issued numerous violations to the billion-dollar company, but after more than 2 years of investigations have yet to impose financial penalties. A spokesman for the North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality told Inside Climate News the agency, quote, "cannot comment on future enforcement actions, but it continues to work with Brentag to receive data and ensure the completion of the actions required in last fall's notice of violation, including some items with deadlines this month and in May." The Durham Environmental Affairs Board is scheduled to discuss the issue at its March 4 meeting. Brentag Mid-South is a global chemical distribution company that warehouses liquid and granular chemicals in bulk storage in Durham and repackages them for truck and rail shipments. Brentag spokesperson Raquel Shepard did not answer direct questions about plant conditions and the company's efforts to keep chemicals from entering the stream. Instead, Shepard provided a written statement saying, quote, "The issues affecting Third Fork Creek are complex and may be the result of multiple sources that are not yet known with certainty. While Brentag Mid-South's operations are not the source of the site's historical contamination, Brentag has consistently taken numerous steps in close coordination with the City of Durham to help address these issues, as documented in our quarterly reporting to and communications with the City. Brentag Mid-South is committed to collaboration in this investigative process and continues to expend internal and external resources and expertise in coordination with local authorities," end quote. Ideal Ortiz, a community organizer who lives across from the plant, expressed her continuing concern. "It feels like this ominous danger that's lurking in my backyard," she said. "Brentag has the money, and I wish they would do right by us. We know that we have industrial uses around the corner. and none of us have ever made a fuss about them just existing. But we will make a fuss about you deliberately harming us when you know better. A DEQ inspector last September found steel drums outside that had, quote, fluids running down the sides with liquids accumulated on the top, end quote, according to state records. The drums that were found spilling chemicals onto the pallets bring into question how many other pallets kept on site have been contaminated. This was the third time state regulators discovered poor housekeeping at the plant. In April 2025, inspectors found rusted, dented, and leaking drums, although they had been removed by the fall site visit. In March 2022, the state inspected the facility and found barrels that stored chemicals were lying on their side. Others were dented, and, quote, an unknown liquid appeared to be leaking in the containment area. Even more alarming, advocates say, are the chemicals, some of them cancer-causing, that continue to enter the stream from the Brenntag property. Sampling by Brenntag contractors in December found more than a dozen chemicals leaving an outfall at the property's southern boundary. Of those, three were detected above state regulatory or recommended levels, ethanol and the likely carcinogens acetone and 1,4-dioxane, both solvents. A month later in January, the Hall River Assembly, a nonprofit organization that monitors water quality in central North Carolina, sampled the creek behind Burton Elementary School, about 1,500 feet from Brenntag. The testing found levels of acetone at 3,820 parts per billion, or ppb, nearly twice the state maximum for surface water. The assembly detected another carcinogen, methylene chloride, at 124 parts per billion. The compound has multiple uses in degreasers, paint, and adhesive removers, and cleaning agents. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has established a drinking water standard of 5 parts per billion for both acetone and methylene chloride. There is no surface water standard for methylene chloride in North Carolina, but New Jersey has set a maximum of 2 parts per billion. The compound has been found in surface water at an average of 68 parts per billion at some hazardous waste sites, according to the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry. The EPA has determined methylene chloride, a chemical used in consumer and commercial applications including adhesives and sealants, automotive products and paint, presents an unreasonable risk to human health because it is a neurotoxin that can also damage the liver. Breathing extremely high levels can be fatal. Regulatory inhaling or touching the compound can increase the risk of developing cancer, according to the EPA. Brenntag's state air permit allows a company to emit up to 1,600 pounds of methylene chloride each year. When Brenntag contractors sampled upstream of the school in December, they didn't detect methylene chloride. The discrepancy between those results and the Hall River Assembly's could reflect the different laboratories' detection methods. Even though it's unlikely that people drink water directly from the stream, children could be inadvertently ingesting it while playing. The stream runs behind the Burton Elementary School playground and through McDougall Terrace, the largest and oldest public housing community in Durham. The stream flows into Third Fork Creek, a tributary of Jordan Lake, the drinking water supply for more than a million people. State records show the violations from last year included, quote, dark, discolored water flowing from the plant into the stream. Those conditions, plus the presence of chemicals flowing from the property, represents a potential risk for human health through contact with the water, as well as harm to aquatic life. Haw River keeper Emily Sutton said Haw River Assembly would continue to test the creek with help from community groups. We're going to build the evidence that enforcement needs to happen, but we have to rely on our state agencies to hold them accountable through their permits and violations, she said. Brenntag contractors only recently began to test for 1,4-dioxane, so December's results were the first to detect it. A likely carcinogen, 1,4-dioxane, has contaminated several waterways and drinking water supplies in North Carolina, including the Hall, Deep, and Cape Fear Rivers. The compound is found in solvents, degreasers, and even some consumer products. Levels of 1,4-dioxane range from 3.6 parts per billion at the Brenntag property line to 1.49 parts per billion in the stream at the Durham Freeway. The EPA set a health advisory goal of 0.35 parts per billion in surface water that serves as a drinking water supply, and 80 parts per billion for non-drinking water supplies. These are very clear water quality violations, very clear groundwater violations, and it's ongoing, Sutton said. This is a bad actor, and they need to be held accountable. More than 2 years ago, in August 2023, the city fenced off the stream after Brenntag detected high levels of acetone, toluene, and ethanol in water at its property edge. The findings prompted the city to prohibit Brenntag from discharging any runoff or other water from the site. Brenntag collects the runoff in basins, then pays a company to haul it away. Since contaminants continue to flow into the stream, company contractors believe contaminated groundwater is circumventing the treatment system and entering the waterway. To try to isolate the source of the contamination, the company turned off the treatment system 2 years ago with DEQ permission, state records show. As recently as November, Arcadis, a contractor for the company, told DEQ in an email that it repaired recovery wells on plant property, but that Brenntag had not given the approval to restart the system. For more than a century, polluting industries have been built near and in residential neighborhoods in East Durham, abetted by county and city zoning ordinances. My expectation was that each of these companies would act with respect and dignity to their neighborhoods, said Ortiz, a longtime resident. To find out that this has not been the case, and that schools, homes, churches, and community groups have to endure the contamination is really disturbing. I just feel like East Durham can't seem to catch a break. NC State faculty and students call for reinstatement of LGBTQ Pride Center staffer. North Carolina State University students and faculty are calling on the university to reinstate former LGBTQ Pride Center Assistant Director Jay Edwards, who was fired after this month after a right-wing organization targeted him in a so-called, quote, undercover investigation. In the past week, more than 700 people have signed a petition, and over a dozen student and faculty groups have signed onto open letters demanding action from the school's chancellor. Edwards was secretly recorded by Accuracy in Media, AIM, talking about how the center is navigating the repeal of the college's Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, or DEI, policy. The policy reversal was part of a larger repeal of DEI programs across the UNC system. In 2024, the Board of Governors implemented a new rule to, quote, maintain institutional neutrality, in response to executive orders from President Donald Trump, which ordered the termination of DEI initiatives for federal agencies and contractors. Trump has openly threatened to pull federal funding from universities that don't comply with his wishes. Edwards was fired within 24 hours of AIM's baseless allegation that the video showed Edwards was flouting NCSU's new rules. The roughly 3-minute and 30-second video was recorded during the 2024-25 school year, according to reporting from the Carolina Public Press, and appears heavily edited. In it, an unidentified person recording with a hidden camera speaks with Edwards, though that person's side of the conversation is largely edited out. Edwards talks about how NCSU eliminated the Office of Inclusion and Diversity, but the center can still continue its events and programs, adding, quote, we have to be a little more careful. Among the statements he makes is, quote, I think it's so important more than ever to still uplift and celebrate our students. Walter Robinson, chair of the NC State Faculty Senate, told the Indy that while he and others have no choice but to comply with NC State's new policy, quote, I didn't hear or see anything in the video that indicated Edwards was not in compliance. In this case, it just seems beyond the pale to me. It's unfair. Robinson is also a member of the NC State chapter of the American Association of University Professors, which organized the petition and is running the open letter campaign. He noticed that staff like Edwards play a crucial role in student success, saying, having these centers gives students a place of belonging on campus, and that's known to lead to academic success. David Embarras, the chapter president, told the Indy he hopes NCSU will do the right thing and reinstate Edwards, but he and others are prepared to build up to stronger demands if needed. We see it as connected to all the issues of academic freedom, said Embarras. If our students don't feel welcome, and if they feel that the resources to which they'd like to turn to are under attack, then their own right to learn is under attack. Edwards' firing is not an isolated incident. Similar AIM videos have targeted staff at UNC Charlotte, UNC Asheville, UNC Wilmington, Western Carolina University, and NC Agricultural and Technical State University, resulting in at least two more terminations. Ombres pointed out that AIM uses the same strategy each time, doing what he called, quote, hit jobs, aimed at public-facing staff who have less protection than tenured faculty. What is equally disturbing to him, however, is that universities are not asking to see the full recordings. They're simply, in a knee-jerk reaction, dismissing those employees. Robinson echoed the sentiment that saying NCSU's response was hair trigger and an example of cancel culture in action. Universities shouldn't be ceding personnel decisions to outside groups, whatever their political affiliation, he said. I hope university administrators think more carefully before reacting to this external pressure, because if you start responding to everybody on social media, you lose control of your own institution. Asked about the petition, the recording, and the decision to terminate Edwards' employment, NCSU spokesperson Mick Kulikowski told the ND he is unaware if Chancellor Kevin Howell has seen the petition and that he is unable to comment on personnel matters. Edwards has asked for help with his unexpected job loss in the form of donations to a GoFundMe campaign. New Durham Bar has 13 seats, no Wi-Fi, and a lot of charm. A few years ago, my 2006 Camry stopped playing music from my phone. This is written by Lena Geller. While this development initially felt devastating, I quickly came to appreciate the experience of relying on the same 10 CDs. Infinite options are nice. Sometimes it's better just to have the edit. Something of this idea is at work at Swaff, a new downtown Durham coffee shop meets bar, in that it's postage stamp size at 593 square feet. Ruled out most permutations of what kind of bar it could be, leaving what's there pared down and sharper for it. Swaff, which opens at 331 West Martin Street in early March, will serve coffee during the day and flip to serving spritzers and cocktails at night. It's the latest spot from Jesse Gersel, who also owns natural wine bar Delafia on South Roxborough Street. Housed in a narrow chamber off the lobby of the Snow Building, a 1930s Art Deco building with offices on the floors above, Swaff is intimate to the point that setting up a laptop might feel like projecting a presentation to the room. Therefore, it does not have Wi-Fi. There's limited space behind the bar for a spread of bottles and pumps. Therefore, Swaff offers basic espresso drinks without a range of flavored syrup options. That's not to say it's austere. Swaff has the vibe of a place you duck into when you want your day to feel slightly more cinematic. A checkered black and cream tile floor, tiered glass pendant lights that mirror the building's original fixtures, gently tessellated wallpaper, 13 seats, a standing rail, and a couple of tables out in the lobby. It's not trying to be the highest-end cup in Durham, said Gersel, and said prices will reflect that. In the evening, the menu will shift from coffee to non-alcoholic cocktails, low ABV drinks built around sherry, vermouth, and other aperitifs, and three full-strength cocktails, a Manhattan, a Negroni, and a Martini. The wine list will include one white, one red, and one sparkling. Gersel told me he found the space first, then worked the concept around it. What made sense, he decided, was something modeled after coffee bars, where he grew up in Italy, where the bar is the center of the community, and, quote, everyone starts their day standing at the counter talking about sports or politics or whatever's going on around town. I think how we structure coffee shops in the U.S., where you walk in and you wait in line and order at a cash register and then wait on the other side for your drink to be ready, it doesn't create the atmosphere for, like, let's share this morning ritual together, Gersel said. At Swaff, there's no register at one end and pickup counter at the other. The idea is that whether it's 8 a.m. or 8 p.m., you walk up to the bar, order from the bartender, and stay where you are, flipping through the newspaper or talking to the person next to you. Whether people actually want that level of proximity to strangers in a slightly antisocial era is, Gersel conceded, an open question. I'm not sure if anybody actually wants what I want from my morning coffee experience, he said. Maybe that is how people are going to feel, like people are too close. But he added, when you have 593 square feet and 13 seats, it's okay not to try to please every single person. Also, though, in bars, as in most things, having a strong sense of what you are and not losing sleep over what you're not tends to be exactly what draws people in, which is to say that not trying to please everyone might be the surest way to end up pleasing a lot of people. Case in point, Delafia, which Gersel opened a year and a half ago as, essentially, a place for friends to come hang out and drink, quote, natty wine, has become one of the more popular bars in Durham. It's a snug space with a wee astroturf patio out back, and most customers end up sitting at the bar and chatting with whoever's around. Every day I'm shocked that people come into the place, Gersel said. I don't know if it has anything to do with wine. I think mostly people like that it's just a different thing for Durham, a little bit darker, and just its own unique thing. Swaff shares a sensibility with Delafia. Both occupy former barbershops. Neither has an immediately clear how to pronounce name. Delafia is an untranslatable bit of hyper-local Tuscan slang, while Swaff, which means thirst in French, is further obscured by a logo that splits the word in two. So slash if. Gersel cheerfully expects people to misread the name as so if. Both bars were designed to be run by a single bartender. Adam Sobsey, who has been behind the bar at Delafia since it opened, will be opening bartender at Swaff. The one bartender model is part of what lets a place like Swaff exist, without the pressure to pack the room every night, said Gersel. With labor costs low, Swaff doesn't need to be a hit. It just needs to be itself. And if Delafia is any indication, that quiet confidence is what will end up making people want to come back. Swaff will be open 6 days a week, closed Sundays. Hours run 8 a.m. to 10 p.m. weekdays, and to midnight on weekends. Kushner, Singh, win Wake County Board of Commissioners primary. Kristen Kushner and Mona Singh were the top vote-getters in the seven-way Democratic primary for two open, at-large seats on the Wake County Board of Commissioners and will progress to the general election. Kushner is a former Wake County School Board Chair who lives in Raleigh, and Singh is a technology consultant who lives in Cary. They received 30% and 22% of the vote, respectively. Kushner's primary success continues the trend of Wake voters electing former school board members to the county commission. Sitting commissioners Susan Evans and Tara Waters are both school board veterans. Singh is a less orthodox choice, a first-time candidate with a background in technology, business, and local political organizing. Raleigh City Council member Jonathan Lambert Melton placed third, earning 18% of the vote. Community activist Kimberly McGee placed fourth with 10.96%, followed closely by former Morrisville Town Council member Steve Rao with 10.85%. Candidates Robert Michener and Margaret Creel came in 6th and 7th. Kushner represented Raleigh on the Wake County School Board for 11 years, including two as board chair. She's currently a member of the Wake County Health and Human Services Board, where she helps set county policy on everything from mental health services and immunizations to Medicaid, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, and the Women, Infants, and Children Program, WIC. Her professional background is in public health policy. Between Kushner's education and the health policy expertise, she said she's prepared to oversee Wake County's $2.1 billion annual budget, a third of which goes to the public school system and another 15% of which covers human services. I am honored to have earned the trust and support of Democratic voters across each of Wake County's 12 municipalities and everywhere in between, Kushner said in a press release after the results were finalized. I want to sincerely thank every candidate who put their name forward and ran a positive campaign on the issues. I look forward to working alongside them to ensure we elect two strong Democrats to the Wake County Commission in November. Singh has about 130 patents to her name from her contributions to smartphone technology and augmented reality. In her spare time, she volunteers with the Wake County Democratic Party. She is the former precinct chair, teaches English to refugees, and serves on the Town of Cary's Information Services Advisory Board. Originally from Delhi, India, she told the Indian ahead of the election that her vantage point as an immigrant gives her a special appreciation for the democratic process. She has big ideas about using smart technology to make Wake County's government run better and finding creative ways to tax the county's wealthiest residents. This was Singh's first run for office, and her victory is a bit of an upset. She surpassed Lambert Melton and Rao, two candidates with previous elected experience and plenty of name recognition, both in the vote total and in the fundraising. Per her most recent available campaign finance report, Singh raised about $133,000 this election, the most of any at-large commissioner candidate. Lambert Melton raised about $131,000, Rao about $120,000, and Kushner just under $113,000. Creel raised about $8,500. McGee and Michener do not have any finance reports on file on the State Board of Elections website. Singh also collected dozens of local endorsements, including from the Wake chapter of the North Carolina Association of Educators, NC Asian Americans Together, and most of the Cary Town Council. Cary Town Council member at large Carissa Cone Johnson said Singh helped her and many of her town council colleagues get elected over the past few cycles, and they did what they could to return the favor. Mona Singh is a power canvasser, Cone Johnson wrote in a text to the Indy. She turns out thousands of votes by hitting doors and having in-person conversations with voters. She knows what people think, feel, and want to see because she has spent years talking to them one-on-one. Lambert Melton congratulated Kushner and Singh in a Facebook post Wednesday morning, writing that he fully supports them and is, quote, focused on finishing the rest of my term on Raleigh City Council, which expires in December, and doing everything I can to help elect Democrats up and down the ballot this fall. Kushner and Singh will appear on the general election ballot, along with Republicans Gary Dale Hartong and Kyle Sotogowski, who did not have a primary. Wake voters reliably elect Democratic County Commissioners, so the race is Kushner's and Singh's to lose. In Durham, the ambitious beatmakers of Roundhouse are building their own home for electronic experimentation. Inside Boom Club, the atmosphere is tranquil. Synthesizers and keyboards line the walls of the space with a low, static hum that flows through the air like a siren call, beckoning visitors to explore the unlimited sonic potential of the electronic instruments on display. Durham's Build Our Own Music Boom Club, founded by Rochelle Sicarot, Nick Williams, and Sean Thegan, is as much for the novice as for the nerd. Unlike traditional instruments, the machines in the space don't require years of music theory or an understanding of scales and pitch to start. Just press a button or twist a knob and see where the sound waves lead you. The first iteration of Boom debuted as a one-day pop-up event at the Fruit in Fall 2024. Sorry, a pop-up event at the Fruit in the fall of 2024. Williams said the club moniker is more after-school AV club than country club. He wants Boom Club to be a place where, quote, freaky, semi-disreputable, but open-hearted people can come and leverage the space's resources to learn and experiment with all kinds of music and be part of an inclusive music community. It's really hard to be a professional musician, Williams said. It's almost impossible for most people, and we can't really change that. But we can create a place where people can be seen and appreciated and part of a local music culture. Because once you're part of something like that, nothing feels better in the world. It feels so good to be a building block in a local culture. The space opens at 600 Foster Street, inside the space formerly occupied by PS37, on March 6. It offers day passes and long-term memberships for folks to access the instrument library. Higher tiers include tutorials and workshops, as well as entry into Boom Club events. Aspiring Triangle Area musicians can apply for discounted and free memberships. Last summer, Boom Club set up in a defunct train car at American Tobacco Campus, affectionately called Electric Choo Choo, with dozens of synths for passerbys to experiment with. Acclaimed artists like Susie Analog also hosted workshops on the craft of making electronic music, as well as its history and subcultures. Recently, the team hosted a Modular 101 workshop in Durham and at North Carolina State University. Boom Club's new space will allow them to expand those offerings, with artists already lined up to provide expertise. Sikkarat has spent much of her career curating art as a public art coordinator with the city of Durham and as an event promoter. Several years ago, she decided she wanted to experiment with music, but accessing the necessary gear, which can cost hundreds, if not thousands of dollars, was a barrier to entry. Founding Boom Club was her way of breaking down those barriers for herself and others. When I was thinking this through before we started, I was like, that would be great for me too. And it has been, Sikkarat said. This is a place where I've learned so much and continue to learn what I want to do with these instruments. Sikkarat serves as a gadget translator of sorts for other folks who come to Boom Club, with little technical knowledge, helping guide visitors from a place of equal footing. When someone comes in, I say, feel free to just play with it. Let's explore this together right now, Sikkarat said. A majority of the synths and keyboards belong to the Boom Club team, with a few vintage instruments also on loan from Alex Maiolo, a Chapel Hill Carborough native and longtime friend of Thegan and Williams. Unbeknownst to Maiolo, who recently moved to San Francisco, his gear might have found a new permanent home. This is a good time to announce that we're never going to give it back, Thegan jokes. Thegan and Williams are veteran performers in the local music scene. Williams was one of the original co-founders of the Pinhook in 2008 and has played in numerous bands around the Triangle. Thegan hosted his own radio show on WHUP from 2015 to 2017 and performs as a DJ and musician under the moniker Ultra Billions. The two met at a concert over a decade ago. Thegan said he couldn't help but notice Williams' F. Buttons band shirt, that's a swear word abbreviated for our broadcast, band shirt, and was surprised to meet another fan of the obscure British electronic duo. Thegan and Williams' interests are shared by a flourishing electronic music scene, one which was particularly robust a decade ago. Roundhouse, a Durham-based DJ collective and music label home to a roster of elite sample mixers, button mashers, and knob twisters, emerged in 2016 as one of the forerunners during that creative boomlet. Artists from the label routinely performed on stage at music and technology festival MOOCFest, which relocated from Asheville to Durham in 2015, before halting in 2019. The festival's four-year run gave Triangle artists an elevated platform to showcase skills for an international audience. On a recent Sunday afternoon, Boom Club and Roundhouse teamed up for a friendly beat-making competition before launching into the Roundhouse 10th anniversary party later that night. Roundhouse co-founder Nick Wallhauser and Thegan previously collaborated on a series called Micro Machines. He called Boom Club's move into the old PS37 space a perfect fit. They're trying to cultivate a community and give it a home base for people to come and experiment and have access to things, Wallhauser said. Music, like any other subculture, can be intimidating to those on the outside looking in. Boom Club was founded to diffuse any air of exclusivity, Thegan said, as well as to reshape notions of what electronic music is. My real dream would be some 12-year-old comes in, samples a mini Moog on their iPhone, and makes music we've never heard of, Thegan said, adding that he wants to get rid of, quote, some of that barrier of what electronic music is. Last time I checked, he continued, any recorded music involves microphones and electronics, so unless you're playing a banjo in a forest, you are involved in electronic music. He imagines many of the folks who visit the Synthesizer Clubhouse won't necessarily be aspiring full-time musicians, but also hobbyists and enthusiasts nurturing their creativity. You don't have to be a professional musician as your goal, Thegan said. I like to play basketball. I'm not trying to make the NBA, but it doesn't mean I don't enjoy doing it. North Carolina bands lead exit of Wasserman Agency over founders' Epstein ties. Wednesday, And Sylvan Esso have both announced that they are choosing to no longer be represented by Casey Wasserman's eponymous agency. Several high-profile artists have spoken out against the Wasserman agency this week, following CEO Casey Wasserman's appearance in a new tranche of Epstein files. In an open letter last week, Best Coast Bethany Cosentino led the charge by asking the talent agency to remove her band's name from its website, calling on Wasserman to step down. Other artists, like Chapel Roan, Wise Blood, and North Carolina bands Sylvan Esso and Wednesday, have taken a stronger stance and cut ties entirely with the prominent agency. The artist departures come amid growing national outrage over the scale of horrifying abuse and the breadth of Jeffrey Epstein's circle, as revealed by the files, as well as frustration that powerful figures complicit in the crimes are not being held to account. Continuing to be represented by a company led by and named after Casey Wasserman goes against our values and cannot continue, Wednesday, an Asheville indie rock group, wrote in a statement posted to Instagram. For the sake of his staff, we hope that he steps down from the company and it is rebranded. The newest files, released by the Department of Justice on January 30th, comprise 3 million documents related to Epstein and his accomplice, Ghislaine Maxwell. Under the Epstein Files Transparency Act, signed into law on November 19, 2025, 6 million unclassified case documents were required to be released within 30 days. The DOJ has been heavily criticized for the partial release and delay timeline, as well as redactions that shield the identities of potential perpetrators, but not their victims. Maxwell, who was convicted of sex trafficking in 2021, appeared before the House Oversight Committee for a deposition on Friday 9th, but refused to answer questions. Sylvan Esso's Amelia Meath and Nick Sanborn, who have earned a reputation for taking a strong stance on industry issues like Spotify, posted in a February Instagram story that Wasserman's ties to Maxwell are so reprehensible that we can no longer work our work to have any association with his name. We have run out of time for today's episode of Indie Week. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Scott Heath, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Indie Week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.